This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Sorry to all you future listeners. I've just gone over the three marks of existence, and they are impermanence, suffering or unsatisfactoriness, and non-self. And last week we talked about impermanence, and today we're going to have a really good time talking about suffering. And I know you don't believe me, but we are, and it kind of depends upon you being willing to play along. So let me just tell you at the outset that when I do, I'd like your participation because it will make it more fun to talk about suffering. When I do this with my hand, it's the only thing I could think of. I mean, it'd be like this, but let's keep it simple. If I do this with my hand, I would like you collectively to make whatever sound you think is like the electronic ding, ding sound that you hear off of your phone. It'll make sense eventually, but let's just practice a couple of times. And by the way, you can change your ding sound from time to time. You'll have ample opportunity to make that sound. So you can change it every time, just use a different voice. But what I would like you to do is pretend like we're one body with a lot of voices. So here we go. Let's just try a couple of rounds. And you can do it online too.
Ding.
Okay, a little shorter.
Ding.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay, one more time.
Ding.
Okay, great. Thanks. It's already fun, right? Okay. So a little background on suffering. Many of you probably know that the Buddha's first three truths, the first teaching he ever gave, they're called the Three Noble Truths, ennobling truths. They're not noble on their own. You have to enact them. So I like to say ennobling, but the Three Noble Truths. The very first teaching the Buddha gave was there is suffering. There is dissatisfaction. There is unsatisfactoriness in existence. So, you know, there's a reason the Buddha made this his very first teaching. There is unsatisfactoriness. And I've often thought that he made it so that you would focus. The first words out of the mouth of the Buddha, the awakened one, was, if you don't pay attention to the places in which you suffer, you will have no reason to ferret out their causes and conditions, and you will have no reason to be free of them. So his first truth is, in existence there is suffering. The Buddha also taught that our suffering, our experience of suffering, is very cyclic in nature. So this is called samsara. Samsara is the cyclic, repetitive way in which we circle around our suffering like a dog chasing its tail. Here we go again, folks. That's samsara. And samsara is not a place. So like if I move to upstate New York, I'm not moving to samsara. And if you move from the Midwest to California, you are not moving away from samsara. It is not like that. It is, interestingly, people move to upstate New York and away from the Midwest and buy new cars and get new partners and do all sorts of crazy stuff, thinking that they can get away from samsara, but it doesn't work that way. And sooner or later, the newness and the novelty and the shininess of the new house, the new partner, the new job, the new look wears away, and there you are, back in the cycle of samsara. And the reason it doesn't work is because of the Buddha's first truth, which is existence involves some dissatisfaction. And happiness is not out there. So you can't go get it. Even though the whole world wants to think you can. That's what advertising is. So the next of the Noble Truths is there is an origin of suffering. And the Buddha tells us the origin of suffering is tanha, which means, it's translated as thirst or craving. And the Buddha actually details in the Dukkha Sutta, he said there's actually three types of suffering. You're not going to be surprised what they are. There's dukkha-dukkha, like super pain, suffering of suffering. And that is the suffering we have for change itself. You know, we don't want things to change. Resisting unpleasant experiences is dukkha-dukkha. It sounds so much like what it is to me, dukkha-dukkha. The second is viparinimas dukkha, and that is not wanting things to change because we like the pleasantness of it. So first we want to avoid stuff, and then we don't want things to change because we really like it. So there's the second one. And the third one is sankhara. Sankhara is formation, mental formations. And this is, I sometimes think of it as, well, young people call it maybe the metta of suffering, because it is our ideas about suffering. For example, the shoulds in our life, or our anxieties about things shouldn't be this way, shouldn't. These are our formations. And even if these formations that we're creating, mental formations, are unconscious, largely unconscious, they still create suffering because it's a way of insisting that the world match our needs and our expectations. So those are the three kinds of suffering, and they're probably familiar to all of us. We like more of this ice cream and less of that. We'd like less war and more peace. And we certainly think things shouldn't be the way they are a good deal of the time. There you go. Those are all the ways in which we suffer. So some of you know the Buddha's story, but I'll give you the Reader's Digest version. You probably don't know what Reader's Digest is, but in any event, it was like these little magazine that had everything kind of boiled down to kind of sometimes vapid explanations. This won't be vapid. But the Buddha's story is he knew from suffering. Okay? He was just like us. He was not a god. The Buddha knew from suffering. His mother died within days of his birth. So right out of the womb, there's a psychic wound. You might understand from what you understand of the Buddha's life is that his spiritual practice was kind of jump-started by suffering, because he led this very protected, privileged life, and then he saw the four sights. He saw old age. He saw sickness. He saw death, and he saw a mendicant, a spiritual seeker. Three of those four were very related to suffering for him. And you might think that the Buddha's teaching that there is suffering, this first noble truth, is because the Buddha saw old age, sickness, and death. But I don't think that's what he's saying. Those are inevitabilities if you're alive, old age, if you're lucky, old age, sickness and death. I think that the Buddha's teaching is that those aren't the problems. The problem is our resistance. And that is the distinction I want to make about dissatisfaction and suffering. And in fact, I thought this expression, this is from the Satipatthana Sutta, and this is a really lovely way of saying exactly what I'm distinguishing here, I think. Let's see. So I just talked about tanha and thirst, and I'll talk about that a little bit more. That to suffer is due to some form of attachment is in fact the implication of the second noble truth, according to which, in order for the unsatisfactory nature of phenomena in the world to lead to actual suffering, it is necessary for craving, tanha, to be present. As the third noble truth indicates, once all traces of attachment and craving have been eradicated, such suffering is also eradicated. Thus, suffering, unlike unsatisfactoriness, is not inherent in the phenomena of the world, only the way in which the unawakened mind experiences them. So, you can do with that what you will. I think it's an important distinction. So, the Buddha, in the Asu Sutta. Asu means tears. This is the discourse, the teaching on tears. In the Asu Sutta, the Buddha said, all of us, everybody who's ever lived has cried more tears than there are in the four oceans. We've cried more tears than in all the oceans. And why are our tears greater than all of the oceans? Because we've all suffered. We've all loved and lost. We've all cried a river of tears, an ocean of tears. All of us, over and over and over again. We forget when a new pain arrives how much we've already been through, how much we've survived. Every loss, every disappointment, every unfulfilled desire has added to the oceans of tears. So we often forget that we've been through some tough things and that we somehow survive and keep going. And this was brought home to me in an interesting way very recently. In February, just as winter storm Fern was gathering her ferniness, my nearly 97-year-old mother asked me to come to D.C., where she lives. She was not in the hospital. She was out of the hospital. But she wanted me to come. Most of us have a hard time saying no to our mothers. When your mother is 96, it's impossible to say no. Even though Winter Storm Fern was looking at me like, I'm going to get you. I went. And it was pretty intense. But at the beginning, it was completely innocent, ignorant, little traveler woman getting ready to go. Three books with me, and I had snacks, which I really only indulge in when I'm traveling. And I was kind of filled with optimism. And I was ready to go, and I got to the airport in the still dark of the morning. And I had my American Airlines app, and it had gotten me a really good seat, and it had gotten me a boarding pass, and I was through security, and I was at the gate, and
ding, ding, ding.
And my little phone read, it's congratulations, we've got you on a new flight. And I said, what? What happened to my old flight? And I looked up the board, it said, canceled. Okay, new gate. And I follow my, you know, I trudge 3,000 miles to the next gate. I'm still pretty happy. You know, I'm getting on a new flight. Okay, great. Got my snacks. I'm okay. I go to the new gate. And just as I arrived at the new gate, I took my seat, I gathered my stuff, I sit down, and
ding! Ding.
My app goes off again. Good news. Your flight has been canceled. But we've got you on the very next flight to D.C. I'm like, okay. So I started to feel a sense of, uh-oh, like a premonition that I might be in a hell realm, and it might be like this a lot. And I was. This began 3 days of
ding.
Over and over and over again. So every time happened, I would get reassigned and I would have to schlep to a new gate. It was always 3,000 miles away from the last gate. You know, it was really bizarre. And so,
ding, ding.
Gate B1,
ding.
Gate C352,
ding.
Gate D5642. It went on and on 7 times in the morning. I would drag my suitcase like a little loyal mule behind me, just arriving, and then the sign would read, canceled, over and over and over again. It felt like an icy cold rebuke, you know, like, who do you think you are? Like that. And there were no agents in sight. There was just circles and circles of travelers looking at their little glowing screens like they were, you know, prophecy stones, trying to figure out where they were going to get, if anywhere. And then the app would
ding, ding.
exciting news. We've got you on a new flight. At one point, I was assigned to a new flight while I was walking to the gate for the flight I was just assigned to. And I had to, like, pivot and turn around mid-stride like a lost migratory bird. I was like, whoa! And I had to go weaving in and out all the other lost migratory birds. We were all just bewildered. And, of course, the place was packed. And it was not easy. Everyone trying to get to the new gate, their new gate, their new Dharma gate. So by the second full day of travel, I had made it to Dallas, even though my first flight was to Virginia. I made it to Dallas. And I sat in the airplane for 2 hours when we landed because I couldn't get to the gate to disembark to get to my flight to D.C. that night, and finally got off the plane, and there were no flights going out now. It was over. And of course, there's the
ding.
Don't worry, we've got you on the next flight. Well, the next flight was at 5 in the morning, and it was around midnight. At this point, you're feeling a little beaten by Winter Storm Fern, which, by the way, on my app, my weather apps, look like a giant frosted cinnamon bun. But I'm from California. What do I know about cinnamon bun skies? You know, I thought, wow, that's kind of pretty. Swirly thing. And so, you know, part of it is my ignorance. I acknowledge I'm weather ignorant. I mean, I've traveled a lot, but what do I know about this kind of weather? So I'm in Dallas, and I decide I better get some sleep. I have, you know, 5 hours, and I go outside to get a ride to an airport, to a hotel. By the way, all the hotel rooms anywhere around the airport were filled because, of course, I wasn't the only one suffering. And but it was negative 11 degrees outside. Now, I don't know what negative 11 degrees is, and I don't have gloves. I did bring a nice warm jacket, but I don't have gloves, and I'm using my hand on my phone to get a car, and I'm thinking, I'm going to lose my fingers. They're just going to freeze and fall off because I don't know weather, right? And I can't go back in to the airport. I mean, I could go back into the entryway where it was not much warmer, but I couldn't get back in. And it really was hard. And any shred of optimism, no more adventure woman was left. Everything was frozen. And finally, you'd think I'd been sitting for a long time, I'd have some insight. Well, finally, I had a little bit of insight. And the insight was, oh, I'm not in control. Right? Duh. I'm not in control. So uncontrollability could be a synonym for suffering. Right? Completely out of control. So I think my little airport drama touches on what the Buddha really wanted us to learn. I told you that in the Discourse on Tears, the Asu Sutta, he says, he advises us that in the midst of our suffering, we have to remember. And what do we have to remember? That we've already cried an ocean of tears, more than the four oceans. We've already done this. We have suffered before. We have suffered great grief and loss and pain. Our flights have been canceled and our seats reassigned about a billion times by life. We have all wept oceans. How many of you have wept for the loss of a loved one? For things not going the way you want them to go in the world. Yeah, we're actually all in the flight together in our suffering. And yet here we are, all are still standing, sitting, and walking. Privileged to live another day after all those tears. And so we're taught that there is kind of an art of suffering. Thich Nhat Hanh. Thich Nhat Hanh says the Buddha has to learn how to suffer. The Buddha has to learn how to suffer. And for me, I have to learn how to put an end to suffering by accepting impermanence. The first of those three marks. By stop my resistance to the fact that things are not going to go the way I want, uncontrollability or suffering or dukkha. These are the ways in which we can learn how to suffer wisely instead of suffer our suffering. We basically have to put an end to this notion that the world should revolve around us, which, you know, no pointing and blaming and shaming, but all of us go through life thinking, it should really work out better for me. And it often doesn't. This is kind of a self-absorption or a self-centered kind of way of moving through life. And it doesn't really work. So maybe some of you are looking at my suggestion that we let go of our self-centeredness as kind of cold comfort. Well, let me tell you, it's not negative 11 cold. But it feels a little barren, right? Like, oh, to let go of the self that thinks it should have it its way can feel a little scary. But it is actually not cold comfort. We have a warm offering to help, and that's very predictably coming out of this now, Zazen. We have this practice called Zazen. And when we practice sitting down and facing, meeting ourselves, we practice with noticing our ideas about things being unsatisfactory. We notice our regrets. We call them regrets. We notice our pain in our knee. We notice our dissatisfaction with all manner of things that we've been kind of attached to. This thirst we have for things to be other than the way they are. So when we sit Zazen, we practice the beginning meditation. People heard me say, we practice allowing everything. We just allow everything to be here because it's here. It's here with us. We're bringing it here, and we practice allowing it. And we practice not resisting it, watching it, observing it, noting it kindly. And we practice not judging ourselves for having these perceptions, consciousness, awareness, thoughts, feelings, emotions. We don't punish ourselves for that. We just observe, observe, observe. And we also try not to cling to the ones that sound juicy and yummy and we want to stay with them. Whether they're juicy and yummy because they identify us as a victim or identify us as a hero, whatever. We just try not to grab on or push away. We just watch. And the element about this watching that for me is transformative really has changed my life. I'm not naturally patient. Those of you who live with me know this. I'm not naturally patient. It's really a practice for me. Oh, I meant to bring my kanji, my ideograph with me. It's hanging on a scroll in my room. But at some point last year, Thoreau was kind enough to do the ideograph for Kshanti, or tolerance, or patience. And it's hanging in my room for a reason, because I need to really keep my mind on patience. Now, another way of speaking about patience is tolerance. I actually prefer tolerance because the truth is that I can really transform my suffering simply by tolerating my discomfort in any given moment. And this is patience, tolerating the discomfort in any given moment. By the way, many of you know Kshanti is the third of the six Parami or paramitas. These are kind of the boat we have to navigate the turbulence, the turbulence of our lives, and Kshanti is the third. We can talk about all of the paramitas another time, but Kshanti is the third. And in various places, the Buddha, as well as a multitude of Buddhas who followed him, say that it's the most important virtue. And you can see why. Because in the midst of our suffering, if we take a breath and allow it, just as we do when we're sitting zazen, it's transformative. We're not caught when we just allow it. And interestingly, when we notice this breath of awareness, of tolerating our own discomfort, we also notice kind of the vastness of this big story that we're in. It's actually not about us. We think it is all the time. That's that self creating a self, creating a self. But it's not about us all the time. We're like just part of this vast cosmos of people and things and life since the beginning of time. It's not just our suffering. It doesn't belong to us. It's everybody's suffering. So what any one of us is going through in the airports of our lives, it's just part of an ongoing expression or manifestation of existence. The second mark of existence is that there's going to be some parts that are not fun, dissatisfying. So, as I said, this way of noticing dissatisfaction and taking the time to kind of be with it can really transform suffering. Even in an airport, the gates can become Dharma gates of joy and ease, believe it or not. And somewhere on about the third day of my journey to DC, something kind of unclenched. So I was pretty tense, and it hadn't been easy. And I was very caught up with the fact that, boy, this is really tough, and there's no one to talk to and no one to help, but there's just this constant ding going on. And sitting back in the airport, where, by the way, I was getting many more ding. And your flight's been changed, and this flight's been canceled, and go to this gate. Something in my body unclenched. Like, before my mind got to it, my body kind of let go. And when I let go, what happened, actually, is a big breath. Nothing fancy, no great mantra, no bowing down, just let's take a breath. And my body said, oh, okay. You've cried an ocean of tears already. There's this breath. Now, some of us sit a lot, and so we're kind of breathologists. We are really familiar with breath, and when we notice it, when the breath says, hey, I'm still here, it's a friend calling. And that's what happened. A friend called. My breath called. And suddenly, the whole world opened up. And this thing that looked like a problem, getting to D.C., that wasn't a problem. It was like a really small inconvenience in the big scheme of things. And how lucky am I that I live in a time when there are airplanes and I could actually see my mother in her when she needed me to see her. By the way, I'm going again on Tuesday and I made a nonstop flight. So, you know, you can learn in the process. But with that breath, that one breath, I remembered the ocean of tears that the Buddha referred to, right? His discourse on tears. Oh, I've been through way harder things than this, and I'm still here. And you kind of sit up like the Buddha that you are and take your noble, dignified posture, and you face your dissatisfaction and your discomfort, and you just are okay with it. In that breath, I was okay. And I knew it was going to go on
ding.
After
ding.
After
ding.
It was going to go on. It might go on until, you know, time immemorial, but I was okay. And what happens when you make that kind of acceptance of the
ding.
And the gate changes and the schlepping and, you know, the whole mess of our shared existence, compassion just pours in. There's nothing but compassion. Nothing but compassion. And it pours into this one, of course, because you're like, oh, no, this isn't easy, but you're okay. You're going to be fine. And then it pours into compassion for all the other stranded migratory birds that are in that airport. And in fact, I shared every meal. I'd get hungry, so I'd go and get not so healthy food. And every time there'd be someone standing there looking hungry, and I can never finish these sandwiches. They're like bigger than my face, and I can never finish them. And I'd say to someone, "Do you want to have a sandwich?" And they'd always, "Oh, yes." And I'd give them my sandwich because why not? They were me, and I was them, and there was just nothing but us. That's liberation. And I couldn't go and get that, right? I don't think when the dinging started, I could have, you know, breathed that breath that got me there. You can't go get this. But practice helps, because you get used to being discomforted, of having things not go your way, of being out of control. Tolerance of your own discomfort allows you to suffer your suffering with some dignity, and actually with this open heart, so that you don't make things worse for yourself or for anybody else. You can be touched, really deeply touched, by difficulties without getting hard, without defending a self that shouldn't be this way for me because I'm special. No, nobody's suffering is special. It's all our suffering. We have all wept the same tears. Sure, causes and conditions have been different for each of us, but this is just life. Hence, it's a truth from the Buddha. Hence, it's the second mark of existence. So I accepted that nothing was going to settle down into any kind of predictability. Things were not going to meet my needs. And because I knew this now, I fully accepted it, I was perfectly happy. It could go on forever. I could still be there and I would be okay. This profound sense of being okay no matter what. That's what happens when you can tolerate your discomfort. You cannot cling to it. You cannot think it shouldn't be here. So my suffering was transformed. I knew the gates would change. I knew I'd be schlepping back and forth over and over again. I knew that flights would disappear and say canceled. I knew that no one was going to come forward and save me. You know, sometimes we just want to be taken care of, but nope, that wasn't going to happen. I was just going to wait. But I was free. I was completely free. In the midst of impermanence, in the midst of my suffering, I was free. I was free within it. Not like suffering went away. There's still dissatisfaction, but I didn't have to feel bad about it anymore. I was free within my own suffering. And then, of course, the adventure shifted. Not only was, of course, I sharing my lunch with everybody that I could nab to feed, but I sat down on the floor with my back against the wall of the terminal, you know, waiting for the next
ding.
And I noticed the incredible variety of shoes walking by. I was down low. I was like in love with the variety of shoes. And I'd look up and I'd see the variety of people and like, oh, I love you all. You know, it just became an overpowering sense of connection to everyone. I actually have a video. I took a video of the shadows of shoes walking by because I was just in awe of this shared existence. Now, the people who belong to those shoes may not have been sharing my experience because I wasn't having that experience a few hours before. But everything that was coming out of this being was full-throated acceptance. Nothing but connection. I had completely stopped arguing with things as they are. I just didn't have a problem with reality anymore. Because guess what? It's reality. So how do we want to respond to reality? You want to fight it? It hadn't really worked for me. So I tried a breath. And in that breath, the whole world of possibilities opened up for how to be okay, even though it wasn't what I wanted. And so eventually there was another
ding
and another little message on my screen that said, "Exciting news! We've got you on a next flight!" And that one mysteriously actually stuck. And I got on a flight and I landed in D.C. and I got to my mom's house and we sat and had a cup of tea. And I shared some time and laughed and cried and listened to her stories. And it was good. I got there eventually. And I'll get there again, eventually. So the problem, dear friends, is not that flights get canceled, or that our lives turn around, or that we get reassigned new jobs, new partners, new everything, or that we get old and sick and die. It's none of that. That's not the problem. The problem is not the pain itself, but just our insistence that we shouldn't have it. We spend our lives racing to get to the next gate, don't we? Yeah. Believing that if we get on the right flight in the right weather, with the right things in our suitcase, everything will be in a land without samsara, a land without this cyclic suffering. But eventually we're going to hit that negative 11 degree weather like innocent children and say, "Oh my gosh, I don't know what to do. We're utterly out of control." And maybe then we'll take a big breath. Let's do that. It always feels good, doesn't it? When we're out of control and we hear that
ding, ding.
You can think of yourself as at a gate of suffering. I called my app, by the way, the American Suffering App. It's not fair to call it American. Poor American Airlines is getting so beat up today. It really wasn't their fault. It was Fern. We want to point at somebody. It's the cinnamon bun Fern. But when we get that ding from life that, oh, it's not going to go the way I want, this is out of my control, we have a choice. We have a choice. We have a choice to accept our bodies as they age. We have a choice to accept sickness. We have a choice to accept death. It's just up to us how we want to move through these inherent sadnesses and griefs and losses. And it's pretty difficult how much we torment ourselves and others when we think that what's happening shouldn't be happening. The Buddha did not offer a better app. He did not offer better weather. He did not offer a less turbulent ride through life. He offered the wisdom of meeting yourself. He offered wisdom of meeting life as it is, not how you think it should be, not how it used to be, not how it should be or maybe will be tomorrow. Just the ability to see things the way they are. And when we do that, when we give up kind of holding tight to how we think it ought to be, the heart really opens. And our grip on the one, the self here, who thinks she's in charge, that whole scenario softens and often just disappears. And someone else's tears touch you in a way that you're not even concerned about your own anymore. And that is where the discourse on tears, the Asa Sutta, actually becomes medicine. We have all of us, everyone on the entire planet, have had innumerable losses. There are enough tears to fill more than the four oceans. Everyone is in this, just like we are. Everything has been dashed, our hopes for how things should be or could be or would be if we got on the right flight in the right weather with the right suitcase. Each of us has been reassigned a new life. Some of us are old and we've been reassigned a new life a lot. Whether it's an illness or a loved one's illness or death, there's a new gate to pass through. And the Asa Sutta tells us you've got to remember you've been through worse. Everyone on the planet has been through worse than waiting for the next flight assignment or whatever it is. We have to remember. So this practice of tolerance for me goes hand in hand with our understanding of the Buddha's second truth of there is dissatisfaction. What are you going to do about it? Take a breath. Try to practice allowing it to be here and just waiting, just like you do in Zazen. You just watch and wait and tolerate the sore knee or the sore back or the itch that you're not going to itch. You don't have to do something all the time. You just watch and observe. Tolerate it. And in practicing this tolerance, we kind of grow up all the way. We're responsible for our lives in a way that is incredibly fulfilling. And then you can stop worrying about yourself and take care of everyone. Give them half a sandwich. Marvel at their shoes. Whatever it is that comes to you in the moment. So, friends, when the gates change, when life turns you in a completely different direction, when you hear the
ding, ding.
May we remember to take a breath. May we remember not to take our suffering so personally. It's not just ours. May we remember how many tears how we have filled more than the four oceans with our tears and how strong we are, that we will keep going because that's what we do. May we remember to suffer wisely with compassion so that our suffering itself becomes the gate of transforming joy into joy. And then we can be awake and free in the busy terminal of our lives. Thank you for listening. Okay, so any comments, concerns, questions, observations about anything? Jackie Chan.
Thank you. I have an observation about the word to suffer. And that's anyone who grew up with any Christian education knows this line. Suffer the little children to come unto me, which Jesus said when people were holding back children. And I don't think it meant that Jesus didn't like children. All right, I'll suffer them. It's because the word didn't mean the same thing back then. It meant allow them, let them come. And I think when we say the word suffering, we could remember the whole history that word has gone through and feel in it something else, which is what you've been talking about today.
Yes. Thank you, Jackie, so much. Yeah, actually, I say that I like to use this unsatisfactoriness. I often use yuckiness because it's, you know, I'm like 4 years old at heart. But I also have noticed it's really the feature is the uncontrollability. And so I often think about, oh, it's the uncontrollability. It's not suffering. It's the uncontrollability of existence. And that helps. You know, you can choose your own adventure and find your own word. And it's important, I think, to not get married to any particular word. Because lots of words, as Jackie points out, have a lot of overlay and connotation in different traditions. You can find your own way. In fact, it's your job. Find your own way. Thank you, Jackie.
Thank you.
Well, since I'm here with my friends online, anybody else? Jennifer.
I was just thinking, can you imagine if everything went as planned and as we wanted and as expected? That would be true suffering.
Yes, it'd be incredibly chaotic too, as if it's not already chaotic. If we had what we wanted all the time, it doesn't seem like it would be very wholesome, does it? Yeah, thank you. Anyone else out in La La Land? Okay, I'll give you another shot at the end. Yes.
Yeah. Look. A question on the second kind of suffering mentioned about when a pleasant experience happened and the mind naturally want to keep it on, and then it's turning into uncontrollably the experience that went away or changed. Or same level of satisfaction, like degraded. And so in that turning point, like when you realize that, oh, like I want to keep the same experience. Mm. So how, yeah, so what's your suggestions to be in those turning point moments? I ask because it's a little bit different from the stuff
that you want to get rid of.
Yeah, yeah, something you want to get rid of. It's a different kind. Yeah, yeah. It's something that I want to have it.
Yes, thank you for that question. If you couldn't hear, I just want to make sure you understood his question, which is that how do we respond to the second kind of suffering, Vaparinama suffering, which is the suffering that we don't want to let go of the good stuff, the pleasant stuff. How do we respond? And I would say that actually, the clinging to it is its own form of suffering, right? Right there, when you realize, I want it, I want to keep it, you're already suffering because you're separate from it. You're not with it. You're trying to hoard it, right? Like, it's mine. Give it to me. I want to keep it. And for me, I would say, and you know, you have to try and then come back and report, okay? But for me, it's the same antidote, which is tolerating, taking a breath, and tolerating my noticing it's not going to last. That's the nature of the discomfort there, impermanence. I want to keep it, and it's going. And we can say this about, you know, not just pleasantries, but our loved ones. You don't want them to suffer. You don't want to lose them. And we want to hold tight. It's natural. There's nothing wrong with it. Nobody should feel like you should punish yourself. This is just human. It's okay. For I know it's just existence. Maybe the bees and the bunnies have the same experience. I'm sure the trees do. So it's the same thing. Can we tolerate our discomfort so that we enjoy what we're in this moment of enjoying whatever it is? You know, I'm flying to see my mother again. Now she's really at the end, and I've been thinking quite a lot about my brothers are really suffering. They're not Buddhists, so they don't have a lot of practice letting go. And I hope I can help in some way to just say, it's okay. they know it's coming, but they want to hold, and my mother needs to be let go, right? Like all of us need to be let go, and we need to let go of the things that we want to grab. It doesn't work if we grab. It creates more suffering. Not only for the one who's saying, I don't want it to go, I don't want it to go, I don't want it to go, but also for the whole world. Everywhere we go, we're bringing our suffering with us. It just pours out. So can we make peace with the fact that we gently, kindly acknowledge, yeah, I really like this, and I don't want it to end? It also helps us to remember to enjoy it. Every last breath. Anyone else? Yes.
How about the physical suffering? Like really, really painful, like you basically cannot observe the pain. You just, like, you can't think. How about those kind of suffering?
Right. I don't want to suggest to anybody that pain isn't real. Pain is real. And severe pain is severe pain. There are some teachers, Darlene Cohen comes to mind, who were in incredibly chronic pain. And they've written books, actually, about how to practice with pain. The gist of it, although I recommend you read her own words, the gist of it is you can be with your pain and not suffer the idea that it shouldn't be happening. This is tough. A really intense practice. But, you know, the fact is we do this all the time. I mean, again, sitting zazen is a good practice field for this. Because how many of you here feel a little uncomfortable sitting zazen? Right. That little taste, just amplify that quite a lot. And at various times in your life, you're going to have severe pain one way or another. If you practice with experiencing this pain and not thinking it shouldn't be happening and not calling it yours, this is a very important feature. It's really the third mark of existence, so I don't want to get into it today, but the identity of yourself as a victim. I've been whatever, fill in the blank. There is pain. There is victimhood. But in this moment, you have a choice. So I'm not going to deny there's real pain, and you have to address it over and over again. And I would listen to that body. The body, there's a great book called The Body Keeps the Score. The body keeps the score. Listen to the body. Take care of the body. Don't deny what's here, right? We're talking about zazen, allowing everything. Don't deny that. I tell people who think they have to sit really hard, if you're really uncomfortable, practice with the discomfort for a while, and then please make yourself comfortable. We are not here to increase your suffering. So don't do that to yourself. Take care.
Yes? I have a question on how to grieve, because I feel like I almost cling to suffering. I don't want to let go of suffering, because for me, it reminds me of someone who passed away. And I kind of feel bad if I don't feel that pain anymore. So I don't know how to really transcend. It felt like clinging to that pain is the only way I still remember the person.
Yes, I have been there and done that. And I often tell people that grieving is its own process, and you have to really respect it. I like to use the term grieve like a ripe peach. Somebody in the hospital where my husband was dying said that grieve like a ripe peach. You know how juicy they are and just runs down your face? Let it run out of your face. Let it run out of your body. Grieve like a ripe peach until you're manufacturing the grief to remember that you're not experiencing it in your body anymore. You're creating it to remember, because you don't know if you let go of the ripe peachiness grief what's left. And I know what's left. And many other people here know what's left. It's love. And it doesn't have to be only, it's like this. You know, we put our hands together. This is the grief. This is the love. They don't have to be separate at all. You can really just have it all at the same time. They're not separate, in fact. How many people here have lost someone you love? It's so human. And you don't have to grab it. Let it work its way through you. I mean, this is what I did. I don't know, really. I don't have the answer for you. You have the answer for you. I trust you to find your way. But there is a kind of a transcendent beauty in grieving that eventually you'll be done with. And you can't grab it, because then you're actually identifying with it in a way that's about you now, as opposed to really about the love, which is what that grief represents. So I think in my case, I've had to let grief have its way with me, which made me kind of pathetic. Jarrett was around for many of my pathetic years, where, you know, I'm still a little pathetic. If someone talks about crying, I'll start to cry. Like, I just feel very connected to, I know what it's like to walk in those shoes and to cast those shadows on the terminal floor. I know what it's like. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's a gift to connect like that. So you'll find your way. You have to speak really loudly. Oh, sorry.
Thank you so much for your talk. One takeaway I have is letting go of things that you don't have control over. At the same time, I think in life there are a lot of things that we have control over, mm-hmm. including the control of not to react to things that you don't have control over. Mm. Do you have any tips how to differentiate when to let go of things you don't have control over, but when you have to? Mindfulness and recognize that there are things we have control.
Yeah, so really wonderful question. You're actually kind of talking about free will. Like, I have this little thing where I say there's no free will, but you're completely responsible for your choices. So you're not in charge of what happened for most of what got you here, right? And yet, you had something to do with it. Basically, existence is about mutuality. You know, there's nothing that not a single thing you could say you've done that was because of only you. This is, again, the third mark of existence, non-self. Everything is interpenetrating. Everything is co-arising all the time. And now, what's right in front of you? What's your name?
Vivian.
Lillian. Lillian. Are you serious? That's my mother's name. There are not that many Lillians. Wow. Hi, Mom. You look great. Her name is Lillian. Wow. Anyway, Lillian, it's really lovely to meet you in this form. So you have a choice with what's right in front of you, Lillian. Like, what's right in front of you? And, you know, the thing is, you can't be in charge of the outcome. You have to put your whole heart in. At the end of Sesshins, when we have a week-long sit, Rain knows this. I like to do the hokey pokey. You know that dance? You put your right arm in, you take your right arm out, you put your right arm in, you shake it out about. You do the hokey pokey and you turn yourself around. That's what it's all about. And at the end of the song, you put your whole self in. You put your whole self out. You put your whole self in and you shake it all about. You do the hokey pokey and you turn yourself around to meet what's here right now. And that's what it's all about. So that's how you know. You put your whole self in. Whatever that is, I don't know what it is, but whatever it is, and we don't actually have an opinion about what it is, it's just right here in front of us. And we take care of it to the best of our ability without trying to control the outcome. And that's hard for most of us because we're used to doing a good job, getting a gold star. Aren't I good? And instead you have to just do your whole thing. And you know what? The outcome may not be what you want. And people may say, grumpy at you about it. They might not like you, even worse. You're fine. As long as you went at this with a whole heart, a whole wholesome heart. And if you're going to ask me what wholesome means, it means doing no harm here, doing no harm there. So for me, that's the distinction. And sometimes things come at me and I really want to react. Like, you know, there's Hokyo is here, one of the teachers. I don't know if he's here right now. Are you here, Hokyo?
I'm here.
There he is. We had this really wonderful rambling conversation yesterday. He's a wise old Buddha. And we were having fun talking about how things arrive in the body first. And you want to, I mean, you don't even have a kind of the pause to not react. It's just like a tsunami in the body, right? But again, practicing on this seat of enlightenment, you can learn to feel that wave, observe it, and pause. You take a breath, and you choose. You're responsible. You're responsible. There's no getting away from the karmic results from your choice. So do your best. You know, that's all you can do. Everyone else is doing their best too. And maybe, you know, let's not take it too seriously. You know, let's just not be too hard on ourselves or on anybody else. Just, you're doing your best. Really doing your best. That means not holding up a mask of a self and saying, look at me. Aren't I doing great? Not that. Vulnerable. Best. Meaning, you know, vulnerable has, it's like Jackie, it's like suffering. It has a bad connotation, I think, even with Brené Brown. But vulnerable is a superpower. It means you're going to be there and face it with an open heart. As I said in the talk, without getting hard. It's a superpower. And you can develop that by just sitting and tolerating what you meet here. So it's important to pay attention to what arrives, whether you're sitting here or driving a car or in line at Trader Joe's or at the DMV where lots of people get reactive. Wherever you are, just what do I want to do in this moment that will cause no harm? And it's a discipline. I mean, even though I'm in this shaft of light and I feel very holy, I am not holy. I am just you. You. All of you. And you are just me. So I make all the same choices you make. I just try to do a good job. I'm consciously trying all the time to meet my vow, which essentially is to not make things worse. So you're going to have to find your way. And Lillian, I know you will.
Can I comment on the last?
Yeah, just before you get a second chance, I just want to make sure I haven't denied anybody a first chance. Yes.
Thank you, Lillian, for your dharma. So you said about put your whole heart into something. How do you remind yourself? Like if you make a choice that is so risky, that's maybe even putting your, it's like throwing yourself into adventure that you have no clue, and everyone else is, like all your rational mind is telling you, maybe this is not the best choice. It's not the safest. It's not the best. And you get to grasp nothing, but there's some intuition. Maybe it's like it's totally false intuition, but you somehow just want to choose it. But once you choose it, once you put your whole heart into it, what if I have no control of the result? How do you keep reminding yourself in the aims of, you know, like everything can happen, that I actually made a choice and I'm responsible for it? How do I? Mm-hmm. Because in that path, things can happen, and I could be like, okay, I could be blaming myself. I made a totally wrong decision, and now what I do? So how do I still sit up straight and just...
Yes, that's exactly right. I just want to make sure online that you heard this very poignant question, which is, how do I make sure I'm making a wholesome choice? How do I make sure I'm doing the right thing? And she ended it by saying, how do I get myself to sit upright? And I think that's your answer, actually. What feels in your body upright? Now, I want to say that in life, things move fast. And sometimes you're called upon to respond very quickly. And it's not like you've got firm ground underneath your feet. You feel like, I don't know. You have to bear in mind that some of the I don't know is really healthy. Like, it's great. You know, like, I don't know. And so let's look at this with kind of a big open mind and an open heart. Let's look. I don't know what the right thing is right here. Requires some patience. Again, can you take some time and just wait? Not just stating about it, you know, not chewing glass. Just wait let the activity of the decision and the import of the decision settle, like in zazen, and then see what's left and what your body feels like it wants to move towards. I listen to my body a lot. Especially during sesshin, but even at other times in my life when things have been very intense, I have a sense that my mind is following my body around, not my body following my mind. And I don't do any harm in that state. It's very interesting. I don't. I mean, I might. I don't know what's happening in the, you know, in the meta worlds that are flowing out from my conduct. Maybe I'm making a mess. But in the immediate space, when I follow my settled body, I'm okay. And I really appreciate you saying, how do I get upright? Well, I mean, actually, you know what I'm going to say. Sit down, upright. Stand up, upright. Go through every part of your life, upright. Noble, dignified, showing respect for you. This manifestation of life, which is all of us. So if you really have this in your heart, and it really sounds like you do, you're paying attention to wanting to do good and stop evil and do good for all beings, the first three of our vows. If you have that in your heart, you're going to be okay. It doesn't mean you're always going to succeed. But you have it in your heart and your mind. What else can anyone ask? So be the Buddha that you are. You've got it going on.
And Zen.
Oh, I'm getting the bell rung at me. Any more first questions, then I'll come to you. Anybody else? Yes, Ethan.
What is karma?
Karma. Well, you know, you could translate it as cause and effect, that there is an effect for every little motion in the universe, you know. And it's so vast and unfathomable, and it started before the beginningless beginning. And so it's not like you can say, I'm going to make this choice, and it's going to be good, and there's not going to be any harmful karma from this. Well, I hope so. You have no way of knowing. Which is why your vow, your intention, how you want to move through this world is, it's not nothing. It's critical, actually. Imagine if all of us really took full responsibility for our own experience. No more, there's not fear. None of that. Just, okay, what can I do? How can I meet this? How can I be part of it? And, you know, there are karmic consequences for everything. So I don't want to go into all the worlds and rebirth. I always think of that as a metaphor, but I will say that samsara seems to have a karmic component. So the way in which we cycle around our own suffering, I mean, I know I do. How many of you feel like you kind of run up against the same kind of thinking about things over and over again? Anybody else? Am I the only one? Yeah. Well, there's, you know, samsara, this cycling of suffering. You have to do something with your suffering in order to not have this karmic consequence of cycling in samsara. So, now, doing something doesn't mean beating it out of you, and it doesn't mean grabbing it and calling it, I am a victim, thank you very much. Well, of course, we're all victims of causes and conditions. But what are you going to do now? You've got this precious life. What do you want to do? So, does that answer your question?
It's an answer.
Okay. Yeah. Make your choice. Take your stand. Be upright. Okay, anybody else urgently before I come back to my friend right here? Regina, did you have a question? No. Okay.
Yeah, just one small question, both the comments about the control and the uncontrollable. So you mentioned about the pull your heart in. My interpretation, my understanding of it is to accept that your capability is limited, like your intelligence is limited, your body capability is limited, and your knowledge is limited, and also you have your past inclination, which might not be the perfect, then accept that the results is not in your control. There's so many other elements, but still you put your right intention and you do your 100%, your best capability of your imperfect self to do it. This is my general comment when you mentioned that.
Thank you. Absolutely, yes. You work with your perfect, imperfect self to put your whole heart into whatever you do. And then you let go. I've done what I can do. No matter the situation, no matter if it feels like... By the way, you did say something about feeling like you're not sure, not just the first not knowing, which is great liberation, but also the intuition that maybe this isn't right.
Yeah.
That's part of this putting your whole self in. Some information's coming to you about, doesn't quite feel right. Can I put my whole self in to this when it doesn't feel right? It requires a pause. A pause. And you have to figure out, well, is that little voice a pause that is diminishing me from ancient twisted karma, from all time, from causes and conditions, because I was told I'm not good enough, whatever. You know, whatever that is it because of that voice that's coming up? Or is it because there's something here that I haven't figured out what it is, but it's not showing the proper respect for the mutuality of all existence. You with me?
Yeah.
So that has to do with this, putting your whole heart in. Don't put your whole heart in until you can say yes to this. And it's nuanced. And it's not like, oh, this is so obvious, or this is so obvious. It really requires paying close attention. And again, I'm going to remind you, you build that muscle of attention where? That's all. It's just paying attention. Nothing else. Paying attention. You get really good at paying attention. And then you get information everywhere. And then a Lillian shows up. Amazing. Okay. Friends online, you have one last millisecond if you'd like to say something. Before Tyson gets a hook and pulls me off my seat. Say so. Speak up really loud, my friend. I can't hear you.
I may not be able to be heard because I have a short bandwidth on my computer. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
I was really impressed about suffering as a consequence of our own doing, nothing external. I come upon this when I paint, and often I'm painting and I want to throw it away. I'm 3/4 of the way through and I want to throw it away because it's not what I think is adequate. So I get there, I'm about to tear it up, and then I fall in love again. And I absolutely find that something else has replaced this inadequacy, and I had to get there. And it's a pattern. I'm like this all the time. And so I just wanted to say, this moment is really necessary almost for me. And I just think that suffering could be helpful.
Yes.
So that you can open up to something so much more than just whatever we think is important.
Yes, absolutely. Suffering is a gateway. I mean, I don't want to say, yay, suffering, it's so good, go for more suffering. Because you don't have to go looking for it.
No,
but
I
know you don't. You don't. And yet you're willing. You're telling me right now, and I know this, that you're willing to be with it. And I'm really happy that you're not ripping up the art, because it gives you that opportunity. So you heard what she said, that by being with the suffering, she gets to go through it. It is the Dharma gate. It is the Dharma gate. If you avoid your suffering, you're stuck. The world of possibilities is so small. But if you go through it, it's a smorgasbord, and you can eat up.
And find a masterpiece, maybe.
Yeah, it is a masterpiece every single time. Thank you, Seisho. Okay. I think we have to stop. If you really have something burning, I'll be up there with you. So, hands together.
also on page 2 of your chant book, you said another verse.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.